and welcome to our Seven Investing podcast. My name is Simon Erickson, and here at Seven Investing, our mission is to empower you to invest in your future. And we're going to be talking about some really futuristic things today. I'm joined on today's podcast by Max Chatsko. We'll be discussing synthetic biology and industrial biotechnology. And fortunately, we have with us an expert in the space. Joel Stone is the president of Convergence Advisors, joins us this afternoon. Hey, Joel, thanks for spending the time with Seven Investing.
Thanks, Simon, and nice catching up with you again after our last interview.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun with that one, Joel. We were talking a couple of years ago about how synthetic biology is truly becoming disruptive to the chemical industry. And so maybe we start this at the 10,000 foot level first, Joel. There's a lot of R&D work going into these fields. And we've seen for a long time, people using science to do really cool things, right? We harness physics for civil engineers to build buildings, and we harness chemistry for chemical engineers to build chemical plants. But synthetic biology is actually using biology to create feedstocks for the chemical industry and a whole bunch of different applications. Can you maybe start us off by talking about the R&D work that's kind of at the first phase of the fields that you look at?
Certainly, Simon. You know, the interesting thing about synthetic biology, it's really the crossroads of combining arithmetic, you know, algorithms, artificial intelligence, and biology and engineering, just all of those converging in a single area to solve the problems that we would have never thought we could have solved before on really, you know, calculating the modifications that we need to make the organisms to have them make a particular product or a particular material. Unlike what anyone has ever thought. That's really the magic of the artificial intelligence and computational techniques being shared with scientists and microbiologists and geneticists to be able to predict, you know, what vectors you need to change within DNA or today, even in RNA, to have a particular certain kind of outcome. So much of the early stage development, which is now moving more into commercial stages, a great example is if you think, you know, just 5 to 10 years ago, how long it would take to develop a vaccine. And people early on this year said, there is no way we're going to have a vaccine for COVID-19 developed within less than a year. And I said, oh, I think that's perfectly possible, because what used to take years or tens of years can now be done in months or weeks or presently with some of the techniques and technologies, a matter of days and hours, which has allowed this massive transformation. And then taking that to the next step, of moving it into the engineering and the scale up to actually produce on a larger scale. And how is that being done? Well, it's really the R&D people working hand in hand with the engineers and the scale up people to actually begin designing the molecule and or the process at the bench scale. So the scientists really start becoming on the leading edge of doing work at the bench that's scaled down to the micro level that we may have never been able to think could have been done years ago. I mean, what is happening presently is what I dreamed that would be happening back when I got my master's degree in chemical and biochemical engineering back long ago, when nobody even knew what biochemical engineering was, nor did they even know what enzymes were. And now it's like everyday language.
Yeah, so we've seen, you know, like you said, with the vaccine and being developed in less than a year, a lot of companies in R&D, they'll use this metric of scientist years, you know, to develop a new ingredient, a new organism. And it's pretty interesting if you look, even in the last 5 years, definitely in the 10 years, the amount of scientist years spent on, you know, an asset has dropped from, you know, a very long time measured in actual years to down to, you know, maybe months. So some of these bottlenecks are being removed from the R&D in the lab, you know, while working through the lower scales of development. But now it's kind of pushing these bottlenecks further downstream, closer to, you know, scale up and commercialization. So what are some of the bottlenecks that still exist for moving this into, you know, actually commercializing it and getting it to the market?
That is a very challenging question to answer, because there's different levels of scale. So let's say if we're the best example of is if we're scaling up a vaccine, you know, as is what is going to be done by Moderna and Pfizer shortly. Well, they already are. They're already producing product, you know, to build up inventory, and then Johnson & Johnson likely. That order of magnitude of scale is tens or hundreds of liters in fermentation capacity. So what I would typically think in the chemical industry or even in the food industry, that would be pilot scale. And there is so much known by that scaling factor to go from, you know, a 1 liter or a 250 milliliter or up to a 100 liter fermentation vessel and maybe a 500 liter fermentation vessel is actually, in my mind, is pretty straightforward, which is what's allowing this to happen quickly. The challenges that come into play is when you're moving to producing a food protein like an Impossible Foods or a mycoprotein. You know, many of these companies that are making, you know, artificial meats and proteins that would go into the food system, because those are much larger fermentation vessels, tens of thousands of liters or hundreds of thousands of liters. And then you take it to the extreme for renewable chemicals, you're talking about, you know, multiple hundreds of thousands of liters of capacity. And the challenge when you go to that level of scale becomes, you know, how do you control the amount of cooling and the amount of airflow to these aerobic organisms, which are very dependent upon that for their metabolism and for the expression of the finished product, whether it be a protein or a chemical or an intracellular material. And you've also got the mechanical challenges of how do you agitate these vessels when you're the difference between a 10 liter or 100 liter vessel and a 250,000 liter vessel is enormous. And that's always been an engineering challenge, but and it still is going to be, but with the onset of, you know, present day, you know, computerization and engineering design efforts that can be undertaken to figure out those scaling factors, it's much easier now than say it was when we had to do it longhand, even just 10 years ago. So it's really dependent upon whether it's a pharma type of product, which is much smaller scale. And usually those are one use vessels. A lot of people don't know this, but they don't have a fermentation vessel that they're using over and over again. This typically is a one use vessel to allow you to operate under very aseptic or sterile conditions to produce these volumes of materials as needed. Well, you can't quite have a throwaway fermenter when it's a 150,000 liter vessel. It's got to be stainless steel. It's got to be properly piped and equipped to be able to clean it and sterilize it between each batch or continuous cycle. So hopefully that answers your question, Max.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. Yeah, I was coming at it more from the industrial side. So you know, in the early days, we had like the Solazymes, Amyris, Codexis before it, you know, went back to pharma. They were working on these big renewable bulk chemical markets. So, I mean, how close are those to being commercialized? Or it seems like the field's kind of pivoted to different types of markets now, right? With maybe better, you know, higher profit margins, maybe more certainty, rather than these markets like fuels or some of the bulk chemicals that require just massive scales to make work. Like we still don't have a very good handle on scaling up fermentation to those scales for these highly engineered organisms, right?
That is correct. And there has been a significant pivot, you know, to food proteins, surfactants, you know, higher value kinds of materials. I mean, you've got companies like Geltor that's making collagen that's going into the cosmetics industry by having a fermentation derived material rather than have it be from animals. And then a lot of the proteins that are being developed, you know, for the food industry, you know, good value of producing things for food. And plus, when you look at the pivot that's been made, it's really consistent with, next to climate change, our next biggest issue between now and 2050 is, how are we going to feed all the people in the world? How are we going to have enough protein to feed all these people and do it sustainably? Because you can't raise enough animals, you know, to be able to provide enough protein. And you move closer to agriculture by taking the agricultural feedstocks and being able to move them very quickly to producing high value food products without the amount of waste that takes place. Or, you know, typically for beef or poultry or swine, you know, a fraction of the protein actually ends up in the food chain for human beings. And that changes dramatically when you move into direct fermentation of products or producing aquaculture feeds, which fish are very efficient at conversion into protein. So that's why you see a big rise, a lot of interest in aquaculture as a way of sustainably providing nutrition.
There were a few other end markets we wanted to ask your perspective on, Joel. One of them has been kind of the energy industry. We've seen investment over the last couple of decades from big oil companies trying to figure out how to make biofuels, how to use different feedstocks, whether it's algae, whether it's sugarcane, whatever it is. But a lot of those have had kind of some roadblocks and some hurdles in terms of the economics. Where do we stand in the energy industry for synthetic biology? Is it making progress there, or is this still a really difficult market for them to crack?
There really hasn't been a lot of investment in synthetic biology as it relates to biofuels. I mean, you can look at, you know, as an example, a couple of the large yeast companies have developed better engineered yeast that can actually produce some of the enzymes, so that rather than having to make enzymes, you can actually have the yeast expressing the enzyme within the fermentation to improve yields in producing ethanol specifically. A lot of activity going on. It doesn't really require synthetic biology. You can just use traditional readily available microbes that are found in nature in a process called anaerobic digestion, which is basically taking any waste material, agricultural waste from animal food produce waste. A lot of activity looking at, you know, all this food waste that we have from both grocery store chains and restaurants and people's home waste. That can basically be converted into to methane gas, and then that methane can then be converted into what we call renewable natural gas, which is pipelineable. So a lot of companies that are pursuing that. Most recently, Chevron did a joint venture deal with a company called Brightmark, and they're basically co-locating next to beef and dairy farms throughout the U.S. In fact, they just announced a very large project down in Florida that's going to be taking all the dairy waste from a large number of farms in Central Florida and converting it into renewable natural gas that'll make renewable natural gas available to the population centers in the Southeast, and particularly Florida, which is typically constrained and not having a much natural gas available being pipelined into those areas. And then you've got renewable diesel. Again, that's not necessarily using synthetic biology, but where I think we're going to see a pivot and see some things starting to occur is where synthetic biology can be deployed, is if you can produce microbes that can take ethanol and convert ethanol from existing ethanol refinery into higher value chemicals. Just like there's organisms that can take methanol and convert methanol into higher value chemicals or proteins. So I think, and that's all done on a much larger scale. Again, it's commodity. So right now there's so much focused on these higher value markets, but once that technology starts to become mature and people understand, and I truly believe that when we look at the infrastructure that we have in place, with agriculture moving into producing ethanol, it's the logical approach to replicate what happened in the early days of petroleum refineries when they pivoted to become chemical refineries. I think we're going to see ethanol refineries pivot to suddenly start becoming biochemical refineries, where they may take the existing feedstock of conversion of corn into corn sugars, and be able to produce those to produce a high value alcohols, whatever. Much like what I did at Green Biologics, we took an existing ethanol plant and we repurposed it to produce butanol and acetone using our specially designed advanced fermentation and the Clostridia strain that we had selected. And we were on the cusp of using some of our own equivalents, CRISPR-Cas9, which was a technology called Cleave, where we were going to modify the Clostridia to be much more efficient at producing butanol as well as acetone. So I think there's going to be a circling back to that as we start moving forward, and as petroleum companies become the pivot, which they're already doing that. Announcements by BP, by Shell, by Chevron, all the majors have made announcements that they're going to essentially be completely off of fossil fuels by 2050. That's pretty remarkable of having something. We're now approaching 2021, and they're going to be pivoting away from use of fossil fuels. Their only approach is going to be putting those investments, rather than drilling holes in the ground, placing those investments in synthetic biology. That I think we're going to see that start to change here between now and 2030. And then you also have companies like Unilever that recently made an announcement that Unilever is going to have all their products completely not using any more fossil-based fuels or chemicals by 2030. That's only 9 years away for a company the size of Unilever. That's pretty remarkable, which means there's got to be some massive amount of investment.
Yeah, sticking with energy real quick, just out of curiosity, I've always wondered whatever happened with butanol. It seems like a way better fuel additive to gasoline than ethanol. It's got more energy density. It seemed like there were a couple of joint ventures, as you mentioned, at Green Biologics, and then it just kind of fizzled, and it doesn't seem like there's that much interest in it anymore. It seemed like it could also convert ethanol facilities to make butanol. So whatever happened there? Why did it lose? Why did the industry kind of lose interest in it?
Some large butanol plants were built based on petroleum, and with the butanol prices being very much suppressed due to low oil prices, you had to have a much higher product, much more valuable product. That's why Green Biologics, we started moving into branded products with our butanol. And I'm actually working with two different butanol companies now, one Celtic Renewables over in Scotland, and they're building out their demonstration plant, which will be starting up in late Q1 of next year. And that's a perfect technology, completely meeting the requirements of a circular economy, because they're taking distillery waste from the Scotch distilleries and converting it into performance butanol and acetone. And that plant will be producing product in Q2 of next year. So looking forward to seeing that. And then another company I'm familiar with and working with, we are doing a presentation on Biofuels Digest tomorrow, is Catalyx. And Catalyx is a catalyst technology that allows ethanol to be converted into butanol, hexanol, and octanol, the higher chain alcohols, which are much higher value. So the lost interest in butanol for a fuel, because why produce a fuel and sell material as a fuel when you can make much higher value chemicals out of it? So that's why there was so much movement away from butanol, because there was much higher, it as a performance chemical with very low purities, it could go into making butyl esters that required high purity. The butyl esters are used in everything from cosmetics to food flavors and fragrances. So why not go that route versus selling it for its fuel value?
Hey Joel, what is the driver for chemical companies or even consumer-facing companies to make the switch on their feedstocks from what they're using right now. I mean, it seems like for a while there, it was all about the biodegradability. You know, Coca-Cola's replacing hydrocarbons in its plastic bottles because they were biodegradable. And then it seems like there's more of a focus on the yields recently, just a more efficient process. Is there something that keeps coming up, at least for those chemical providers or those consumer-facing companies, that's really driving them to make the change right now?
The most significant piece that's driving that change is the branded product companies, the quick service restaurant industry are all, you know, working towards ESG goals and sustainability goals. So they don't want once through plastic anymore. They're looking for biodegradability in those materials. And that's really the key driver, you know, producing plastic material that can be biodegradable. You know, we used to always think as I was growing up, oh, we can do all this recycling, whatever. But the problem with recycling is you've got to have pretty significant sorting, and you just can't take mixed use plastics out of from a landfill that is a whole gamish of different things and convert them into, you know, convert them back into naphtha or olefins typically, and then produce plastics out of them. I think we're going to see more and more activity, you know, from a polymer science standpoint, and really a combination of synthetic biology and catalysis. I don't think, it's going to be very difficult to get to the ultimate endpoint just using microbiology. You know, being a true believer in it, I'd love to say it, but it's just so much more efficient to get part of the way there, or the majority of the way there, than use the new technologies that are being developed, you know, using nanotechnology and catalysts. That's probably another, from an R&D standpoint, another very big area of growth is nanotechnology to have very selective catalysts. So now you can take the organism, get a process quite a bit down the road and getting close to what the finished valuable material is going to be, and then use catalysis to take it to that next level to end up with the finished product. So you've got the beauty of having a high purity material through biotechnology that can then be fed into catalytic chemistry, and feeding high purity materials into catalysis, you now can have a great deal of selectivity because you're not dealing with the gamish of things in catalysis that you do when you're dealing with a fossil-based feedstock. You can be working with a fairly high purity material without having to worry about fouling up of the catalyst.
And then moving on, just one other thing, Joel, is we've seen a lot of these kind of chemical intermediary companies taking the next step, right, forward integrating to be facing the consumers themselves, whether they're selling shampoos, whatever it is, they're doing the marketing and selling the end products themselves. I mean, whether we're in personal care products and cosmetics or food or clothing or whatever it might be, are you seeing companies that maybe previously would define themselves as an intermediary chemical supplier more and more taking the step to being a consumer brand based on ESG, based on consumer preferences or whatever else it might be?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the metamorphosis in business cycles we tend to go through over and over again. You know, the large companies quite often do not want to be the early movers. So that forces the smaller size companies to formulate their own branded products. I mean, a good example is you have a company like Method that came out with, you know, the biosurfactants and their soaps and detergents and whatever. And what happened? They reached a certain point and then they got gobbled up by one of the majors. As soon as they got to a maturity level, then, and that actually ends up being their exit strategy. You get your product into a particular life cycle and brand it to where there's name recognition. And then a large company like a Procter & Gamble or a Colgate or Palmolive or a Unilever or other branded companies swoop in and say, hey, that's a brand that we want to add into our portfolio. And that has happened time and time again. When you look back into the technology industry, look at all the people that were producing computers and floppy disks, all the things that don't exist today because they reached a certain point in their life cycle that they ended up getting bought up by the larger companies that saw that it gave them a technical advantage. So that's the, you know, that's sort of the modern day upheaval that's happening. That's still the innovator's dilemma. It's still Clayton Christensen, where you have people who are innovating to have these disruptive technologies, but they're a disruptive technology not to ultimately be the survivor and be the big dog, but to be acquired and to provide their shareholder value by cashing out with a trade sale to a much larger company that can take them to the next level.
In addition to using that as an exit strategy, I think that I always wonder why more companies, and they're starting to now, but why they weren't using that to kind of self-fund themselves. So like we're kind of seeing Amers a little late to the game, but you know, they have issues with their bulk chemical business and among other issues, but their consumer brands are actually pretty good and they're growing very quickly. There's obviously a high profit margin there. So I always wonder why companies didn't just start with consumer brands and then use that to generate, you know, lots of gross profits, maybe even operating income. And then use that to help self-fund and offset the costs of, you know, some of these more ambitious projects that need larger scales, you know, the industrial chemicals or things that maybe are less proven in the market, you know, cannabinoids, something like that. So do you see that? I mean, we see that with, so like Amyris as an example. I think Ginkgo started their own JV in meat products. They kind of want to own a little bit more of the consumer aspect of that. You have like Bolt Threads in clothing, for instance. Do you see more and more of that happening as well? From your perspective as, you know, consulting?
Yes, I do. And when I, in my consulting practice, when I talk to companies and they are touting how great their technology is and, you know, they have all these scientists, I said, well, that has no value. And your IP has absolutely no value unless it becomes a commercial product. And I think companies, through all the lessons learned of seeing the number of failures, they have all pivoted in their business strategies, you know, from, you know, not just looking at how cool their technology is and their IP portfolio, but looking at, you know, strategic collaborations like Amyris has done in the cosmetic industry with some of their products. They've now moved into CBDs. You've got the Zymergen, you know, partnering, you know, for their film technology with one of the Japanese firms, to where, you know, they're looking at how can they have their technology ultimately orient them into having a branded product. We did the same thing at Green Biologics. We said, hey, you know, if we're just gonna sell butanol and acetone, we're not gonna be able to survive. So we launched our own branded odorless and smokeless charcoal lighter fluid. And ultimately that ended up being licensed to the big dog in the world, Clorox, you know, to have Ecolite, which was going to be a replacement for Kingsford. So I think that's going to be the ongoing trend. You mentioned Ginkgo, you know, Ginkgo is basically the technology company, but they're spinning off companies like Motif, which is their food ingredient company. Where they can bring in executives that aren't focused on R&D, but they're focused on commercialization. You know, they know the branded product industry. They know how to figure how to raise money to commercialize, whether it be through contract manufacturing or raising money to do their own bricks and mortar to build out their own facilities. So I think, you know, in order to move synthetic biology forward, we're going to see more and more of that happening. You know, Moderna had to partner with other companies to be able to have a manufacturing platform for their product. You look at Pfizer. Pfizer partnered with BioNTech over in Germany because they alone didn't have the capability to commercialize their product. So I think, you know, that's the wave of the future as far as, you know, it's time to market, you know, because you're the burn rates, even though there's significant cost reduction of using synthetic biology to get something done in a year that used to take 20 years to do. I mean, that's saving billions and billions of dollars, but it's still in the billions of dollars to still get a product, you know, to the commercial stage. And nowadays with very limited contract manufacturing capability for the non-pharma kind of products, the food ingredients, that's going to require some investment in bricks and mortar, new fermentation capacity here in North America specifically. There's quite a bit in China that's available, quite a bit in Europe. But when you look at fermentation capacity for scaling up so much of what's being developed in North America, there is a big void of any kind of capacity to take those companies to the next level.
Yeah, Simon and I were talking about that the other day. I told him I'm really waiting for a toll manufacturer who, rather than going full vertical that some companies are kind of forced to do, you know, there's a toll manufacturer that comes out and that's their business. You know, they're helping scale up manufacturing for these companies, whether it's an industrial chemical or brand. That would be a very exciting business to me. So,
well, back when Simon and I met at the bio conference, I spent 2 years before going back into my consulting, looking at doing just that, building out a very large contract manufacturing facility. But it was just very hard at that time, you know, to raise any money, you know, because venture capital doesn't invest in manufacturing capacity. They're looking for it. And private equity and infrastructure funds, they want to invest in a big way, but they want to be in control and own it. So you're sort of in between, you're sandwiched in between those who want things done one way and those who want things done a different way. And you go, okay, how could I just get a facility built? Because I become an insurance policy for the VCs and the industrial and synthetic bio companies, because they need a place, they need a home to be able to produce their products, both develop them further as well as the commercial manufacturing. And you need that commercial manufacturing, you know, when you're trying to beat the clock, you've got a product going to a branded product company, they're not going to do a product launch within and change their labeling and change how they're going to market their product unless they know that they're going to have a sustainable supply. Because in branded products, what you don't want to do is you don't want to false start. You don't want to make an announcement, we're going to have all this whole new wonderful bio-based product, and then people start buying it, the demand continues to increase, then you go, oh, whoops, we can't quite supply. And that's becoming some of the challenges with in the food protein areas, with some of the companies that are producing, the replacement beef and chicken. You know, how do they continue to ramp up to make that amount of product available? And it's created even more stress because they've all pivoted. They were sort of slowly ramping up because they could sell stuff through the restaurant chains. But guess what? There's no restaurant chains. There's no restaurant business left in North America. So they all had to pivot during COVID-19 to say, how are we going to repackage our product? I saw an interview with Beyond Meat. They said, wow, we didn't know how much of a challenge it was to pivot our entire business to have retail packaging and the logistics and moving stuff into retail stores to sell their product. And same thing for Impossible Foods.
Joel, you were mentioning Beyond Meat. You know, the alternative meat industry is something that's really catching on out there. In all the years that you've been doing this, I wanted to ask you, what are a couple of things that you find is really innovative and really futuristic that are taking place in your industry right now?
Certainly. Well, probably the most significant thing that's taken place within that industry is a combination of formulation and application capabilities in food ingredients, because the biggest challenge in producing a food product is not just producing a protein, but producing something that has the appropriate texture and flavor profile. And that takes years, and that's flavor chemistry, textural chemistry, it's really material science on steroids. So what these companies have done, they've been able to say, well, let's combine the biotech side with the food formulation and application all the way through to meeting certain flavor textural profiles, all the way through to having, you know, chefs involved with testing product to say, yes, this tastes exactly like the animal type of product. So, and Beyond Meat did a real good a job of that. Beyond Meat really isn't a, I don't consider a synthetic bio company, except they're using the best of the best as far as agricultural protein, starches, whatever, and the formulation of those materials to give the right texture and flavor profile. Impossible Foods is doing some of the same thing. Of course, they've got their magical fermentation product is heme. But now you've got many of the companies that are producing milk products, egg products, cheese products that are using synthetic biology. Those guys are all on the leading edge. Whatever the organism platform that they've selected to be able to express these certain types of proteins that, again, they end up in many cases, they get added in with other agricultural materials, become a combination of synthetic biology related products as well as agricultural products. And that's probably going to be the trend within the food industry, because it's hard to really meet the textural properties, with a fermentation dried material. Probably the closest you can get is some of the mycoprotein products that are basically fungi that have sort of certain fibrous types of properties that can offer texture, but even those they become a partial ingredient in a much larger picture using other agricultural materials to really provide the entire package that becomes very difficult for a consumer to tell the difference between whether it's beef or artificial beef or chicken patty or real chicken or fake chicken, the same thing with sausages, just across the board. But you look at some of the new things being developed in egg replacement, milk replacement, which are pretty significant. I find pretty interesting. But in hearing the interviews of some of the founders in those companies, they very readily say, "Look, it's taken us 5 to 6 years to come up with the right formulation. We've been working at the formulation chemistry of this, and now that's becoming more predictive because you have ways that you can measure texture, you have ways that you can measure flavor, with new techniques, new technologies that were leading edge, about 7 years ago, but now, with artificial intelligence and data management, you can just manage massive amounts of data for measuring texture and flavor and say, okay, what elements are really allowing us to deliver that appropriate texture and that the appropriate flavor. And in many cases, from a sensory standpoint, even smell. When I was working for Opta Food Ingredients, we had a specially designed testing kitchen where smell was just as important as flavor and texture to put the whole gamish of things together.
That must have been.
That makes me feel old now because the techniques they have today make the stuff we were doing 10 years ago look like antiquity.
Sign me up to work in the smell kitchen. I'm all for that. That's great.
That sounds like a fun job, actually. I could go for that one.
Yeah. So
it was interesting.
There's a lot of really cool things going on in food. I remember, like you said, years ago. I mean, some of these companies are still out. Like today, it's called Perfect Day, but I think it used to be called Moo Free. They're the ones working on, milk.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a cool product. Yeah, that has a lot of potential if that works. So outside of food, though, what are some of the markets you think would be the first to have some more successes here and really kind of push this into, the public conversation?
I think the area of surfactants is very interesting, and that's being pushed even harder with trying to come up with bio-based or natural derived surfactants that can replace some of the fossil-based surfactants and some of the surfactants which have some pretty unfriendly attributes that are produced out from palm oil and palm oil extracts. So I think that's an area, high value area, something that is needed on the industrial, institutional, and home side of things, when you look at that whole area of HI&I, is massive amount that's going on. And the announcement I mentioned earlier by Unilever is going to push that probably at a lot faster rate of people, you know, having the market need someone who wants to include new and different types of materials in their household cleaners or institutional cleaners and detergents that are also, you know, environmentally more friendly as far as, well, when they're disposed of, you know, how do they break down easier when they hit the wastewater treatment plants, et cetera. And then the other areas probably is you know, human skincare and the cosmetics area, you know, with things like what Gelator is doing with the collagen replacement to replace animal collagen with a fermentation derived material. I think there's a lot of interesting things that's going to go on with being able to take bio-based chemistry, bio-based materials, and produce especially esters that presently have to probably be, you know, extracted out of fruits, vegetables, or botanical kind of materials. High value material, not a lot of volume, but very high value, that when you produce those via fermentation and combine several different fermentation materials to produce a molecule, it can still carry forward being able to have a natural label because it was produced naturally via fermentation. And then a lot of the human nutritional kinds of products, you know, the most notable that has become, you know, very, very popular of recent, kombucha, you know, the developed in Japan, you know, the fermentation drive. I see bottles of all this. I go, who in the heck is paying $3.50 a bottle for this stuff? But they are, because it is a healthy kind of material. And use of synthetic biology, a lot of work sort of going on behind the scenes right now on microbiome, you know, microbiome for human gut and nutrition and healthiness. And the studies that are being done that say that many of the diseases, even including cancer, that occur in human beings, many times starts in gut health and being able to appropriately manage gut health. And that also carries forward into animals, gut health in animals. And then you've got companies like Indigo and others that are making microbes that can return soil, return the microbial load back into soil that got wiped out with all the overuse of herbicides and insecticides and fertilizers, to really return the organic load that and healthy organics, which is produced by a lot of anaerobic bacteria that can now be replaced in the health in the soil. And those are very important because those types of bacteria and the peptides that they produce, and in some cases organic acids, but they themselves act synergistically with the root system of plants. So they're actually finding that they can greatly reduce the micronutrient that are added and fertilizer additions, because it allows the root uptake to be such much more efficient. So you have less loss and runoff because the microbes can affix nitrogen, they can affix phosphorus, you know, all these different components that used to, we would just over apply it onto the farmland and then we'd end up with all of the stream runoff. And when you look at the agricultural improvements that can be made, that is big business. And you've got some of the large companies, the Bayers, the Syngentas, the Monsantos, and others of the world that are investing in those. So you got companies like Arbion down in Raleigh, North Carolina, that's working a lot with some of those organisms, and also various kind of fungicides, you know, naturally occurring material to be placed, you know, on fruits and vegetables to reduce spoilage. And some of the coating chemistry that I think is going to be developed. You got one of the fourth largest money raise, you know, the first half of 2020, the fourth largest money raise was $250 million by Apeel. And Apeel is a coating that allows shelf life of vegetables and fruits to be sustained over a much longer period of time, which is a pretty interesting, a company like that that raised that much money. So there's in the likes of the Impossible Foods and the Modernas, you know, I mean, $250 million for an early series raise is that's a pretty good raise.
Joel, we are three engineers that all have some kind of allegiance to the chemical industry here. So this is clearly another two beer conversation for the three of us sometime. But for our audience, you know, that is individual investors at Seven Investing here, are there a handful of companies, maybe just two or three companies that you think are no-brainers from these trends that you see developing out there that are going to be big winners from everything we've discussed here on the podcast? Public or private companies.
You're stretching my memory on that, because I was just looking at the top list of public companies. There's a fellow that has his own index that has sort of a listing of all the companies, and some of those that are in there that are public. Of course, you got Moderna. That's sort of a no-brainer with their COVID-19. I think Amyris is going to be on the upswing. Amyris is a public company. So it's really a matter of, you know, I tend to focus on the industrial biotech, the non-pharma companies as opposed to the pharma. But I could certainly, I could shoot you over, you know, a list post our session today, and that might be something, it might be something we could have a follow-up call on, just discuss, you know, some of the present companies that are in the public domain. And of course, there are opportunities. There are actually some pretty opportunities for those that want to really research and get involved in early stage, would be looking at some of the companies that are very early stage that are doing crowdfunding. And there are some of the crowdfunding platforms which are strictly focused on ESG investing, and to some extent, industrial biotech. I mean, the company I'm working with, a client company I'm working with over in Scotland, we, you know, in order to finish up the demonstration plant, we decided to do a crowdfunding round, and we went out with hopes of raising 1.75 million euros, and 21 days into the money raise, with 8 days left, we're at over 3.2 million pounds. Wow. So because people looked at it, they go, wow, this company's for real. They're going to expand. They're going to build additional facilities. It's a true circular economy ESG investor. And it's pretty easy to sort of look at the investments that companies like BlackRock and other large funds are doing, because they've pivoted to say they're no longer going to do in investing in the normal energy sectors. They're moving to having a scorecard for ESG investing. And there's a lot of resources to just look at ESG investing and which are the companies that probably need to be looked at, if that's one of your criteria. That's becoming one of my criteria for investments, is, you know, what's the scorecard from an ESG standpoint.
It definitely is a trend that's taking shape right now in our world. Max, any other final questions or thoughts for Joel to close this out here?
Stump me.
Should have said that. No, I'll let him off easy. How about that? But this is a great talk. I appreciate it. I'm sure we'll have you back on a couple more times, hopefully.
No, it's exciting to talk about this area. It's, you know, we're this next 10 years, you know, with what we've seen going, I think COVID has sort of pushed us along with having, you know, the technology things to where what we said we couldn't do before, we're proving it, just like on our today's session. You know, we're not doing this live face-to-face across the table. We're doing it as a Zoom conference. And that becomes enabling for collaborations across the board with companies that normally probably wouldn't collaborate on very early stage R&D. And those collaborations is really what allowed so much of the things that are going on with COVID-19. It really sent a wake-up call to say, hey guys, you've got to collaborate cross platforms, and there's probably a lot more sharing of information on this messenger RNA being done with the companies that are being successful, you know, because there's plenty of space for multiple companies. I mean, the market doesn't need to be controlled by one company. We have so many problems to solve, you know, having more and more collaborations. And I think that's going to be another thing, fallout that we're going to see within these different companies, you know, going after surfactants or food proteins. We're going to see more and more of them probably cross-platform and say, look, the sum of, you know, if we add one and one together, we can end up with five, and then that five could end up being a public company that could be very successful. And I think that's in my mind and my vision, what I think we're going to see happening in the next between now and 2030. For any of the young people that are interested in industrial biotech and synthetic biology and the engineering that goes hand in hand with that, this is going to be a renaissance 10 years for people that really want to play a role in it, which is why I'm doing consulting. I see that this is helping younger people figure out what does it really take to build something, because most people never build anything. You know, it's one thing to say, oh, I can build a tree fort in the backyard. It's another thing to build $150 or $250 million fermentation facility. Let me tell you, it's a lot of energy and effort, but it's fun when you see it's done. You just look at it and go, wow, never thought I could do that.
Absolutely, Joel. I'll close it out with actually a quote from you here. You said that we believe that the present industrial and consumer trends are resulting in a reinvention of the specialty performance chemical industry to deliver solutions using industrial biotechnology. I think that wraps everything here together up very, very nicely. Once again, for everyone watching, Joel Stone, the president of Convergence Advisors. Joel, thanks for joining me and Max at 7 Investing here this afternoon.
Well, thanks for the invite, Simon, and thanks Max as well. And look forward to having some more of these as time goes on to get the messaging out. And it's all about educating the masses. And thanks for using that quote, because I use that with people, because it's really about educating people about what is synthetic biology. And I think people are going forward, they're gonna grasp this more and go, look, people, you know, early in the year were saying there's no way we could have a vaccine, and lo and behold, you know, unless we have an inhibitory, you know, matters from a political standpoint inhibit the rollout, we could very well have some of the first people, you know, having vaccines before Christmas, which would be, in my mind, would be fantastic for not just North America, but pretty fantastic for the world.
I certainly agree with you on that one, Joel. Thanks again for joining Max and I. Thanks for everyone for tuning in. Once again, we are here to empower you to invest in your future. We are 7 Investing.
A reminder that people on this program may hold positions in the companies that are mentioned. Buying and selling stock carries financial risk, which could include the loss of capital. The views in this program should not be taken as personalized advice. Before acting on any of the information provided, listeners are encouraged to consult a financial or tax professional.